Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi from Brand Positive, a research, foresight, and strategy consultancy for corporates, agencies, and NGOs. I've spent 20 years working on catalytic projects around the world, and along the way have been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom are guests in this series, along with an array of other fascinating individuals. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, focused on innovation. My next book will focus on foresight. So, I hope you enjoy this podcast, which is brought to you in partnership with the Copenhagen Institute for Future Studies, a global leader in applying futures thinking to solve strategic challenges within organisations. But now, let me introduce today's guest. So today I'm really pleased to be joined by an incredibly interesting individual, Ari Wallach, who's a futurist and social systems strategist, is the founder and executive director of Longpath Labs, an initiative focused on bringing long-term thinking and coordinated behavior to the individual, organization, and social realms in order to ensure humanity flourishes on an ecologically thriving planet Earth for centuries to come. He's also the author of Longpath, Becoming the Great Ancestors Our Futures Needs, published by Harper One. He most previously hosted Fast Company magazine's Fast Company Futures with Ari Wallach. He was most recently also adjunct professor at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs, lecturing on innovation, AI, and the future of governance and public policy. And he is very soon going to be bringing to you, care of PBS, A Brief History of the Future, a unique six-part documentary. So absolutely fascinating stuff. I look forward to hearing all about it. So Ari, hi, and how are you?
Hello, I am great. I'm talking to you here from my home just north of New York City and just enjoying kind of a beautiful winter day, but very much looking forward to the coming spring.
Which takes us neatly to what may appear to be the opposite. So our world is filled with predictions about the future, and whether it's news, movies, books, politicians, etc., it's often presented as a doom and gloom scenario about what the future will be if we keep doing all the bad things we're currently doing. So, Ari, how can we create a prosperous future if we can't envision one?
I mean, look, this is the crux of the problem here. We are hardwired to seek bad things, right? It's our negativity bias, because bad things, and this goes back hundreds of thousands of years, bad things led to us being dead, us being killed. So it makes sense that we are going to focus on the doom and the gloom at an individual level and even at a collective level. Now, this is fine to a point, because it really does help us kind of flourish as a species if we're looking for the things that are going to actually hurt us as individuals or society. The issue becomes when we become wholly fixated on the negative, wholly fixated on all the things that can go wrong, and we don't start asking ourselves, what happens if things go right? What would that be? And now, to anchor that, though, you need, as you said, a kind of vision of what that looks like. Now, what's happened over many, I was going to say decades, but really many centuries, is folks will come out and say, here's a vision of what the perfect world looks like. Here's what utopia looks like. Mm. And we know utopia in and of itself eventually collapses in on itself and becomes a dystopia.
Yeah.
And so when we were thinking about creating this show, A Brief History of the Future, we kind of stepped back and said, look, people are inundated with visions of what the world looks like when it goes bad, when it goes wrong. How do we actually start thinking about visions of what it looks like when it goes good, when it goes well? But what we didn't want to do is put out one singular monolithic vision, because at the end of the day, when you do that, it's just one singular monolithic vision, which tends to actually exclude a lot of folks.
Yep.
So the kind of thesis of the show, the thesis of the work that I've been doing at Longpath, is how do we get folks to collectively think about the visions of the world that they want to see in a way that is both in plural. So we say futures with an S, as you know, and as your listeners know, that's what a lot of us think about now. And how do we do it in a way that allows those visions to almost become like kedge anchors? So a kedge, for those who aren't in the nautical world, is a kind of anchor that you throw 20 or 30 meters off the bow of the ship. It locks on land and then you lose or locks, into the soil underwater. And you use the rope, the long line, to kind of pull you towards that. And so what we realized, and I realized, by the way, I've been kind of a professional futurist for over 20 years working with the UN, the US State Department, major corporations, politicians, you name it, is more often than not, there is the inability to think about what those visions of what the world we want to be. And so the show provides multiple, we have 72 people that are interviewed in the show. Sometimes it's short, sometimes they're kind of characters that we follow, to kind of not say, oh, this is the one singular vision. But these are folks that are working towards a positive vision in their, let's say, singular area. It could be food systems. It could be energy. It could be community. It could be how we care for our aged populations. And that we hope that from that, that actually starts to get folks thinking in their world, be it in business or in family and organizations or in government, to start thinking, hey, I'm going to focus a little bit less on what it looks like when it goes bad and more on what I want it to look like if it actually goes right.
I must say, I think any program that includes such luminaries as Dame Ellen MacArthur and the epic Mbappe has to be 100% avid sort of viewing material.
Yeah, I mean, what we strive to do, and I really strove to do because we finished the show, is find the people who by their very nature are pragmatic optimists. So they're not Pollyannish. They're not saying, oh, you know what? We don't have wars. We don't have these problems. They're saying, look, we have these problems and we could do one of two things. We can kind of sit on our hands or stick our head in the sand or build sandbags around our whatever our thing is and hope to ride it out. Or we can actually work towards solutions that work for all. That was the kind of key. So whenever we thought about who do we want to talk to, it was always folks who had their eyes in two different places, which is very difficult to do. One eye, pragmatic, looking right in front of them, the world as it is. But another eye, fixed on the horizon of what they want that land that they're going to enter into to actually look like. And these are folks that knew how to connect those two, which seemingly seems impossible, right? Because you have near and you have far. But these are folks in their work, they're getting it done day in and day out, but they know where they're going. They have an idea. They have a vision of what success looks like. And that success is different for different folks. But the kind of base litmus test was, if the world manifests, if their work moves forward, and they may not finish it in their lifetime, and several people said that on the show, but if it moves forward, the end result is a flourishing world for all. And so if we could find people who had an eye in front of them, an eye on the horizon that was embedded within a flourishing world for all, they made the cut. And so you'll see the folks that are on the show are these just amazing individuals. And sometimes it's they're doing some work in a very kind of micro way. And sometimes they're working at massive scale. They're trying to clean up the world's oceans. And we went into that and we did that specifically because we knew people would enter the show. It's a 6-part docuseries, 6 hours. It'll be on PBS in the US, but it'll be global soon after, dozens of countries, and you'll, kind of check your local listings. And we knew people would be entering the show from different, POVs, from different places where they sit. So we kind of move up and down the kind of from micro to macro, from really far out to kind of near term, from the very personal to the very civilizational, because we wanted people to be able to access it where they are, as opposed to where we thought they should be.
And something I think absolutely is incredibly interesting here is, as you say, that whole thing about, connectors and the connections that you're making, because, I think that sort of straightforward you say, sort of, you know, philosophical viewpoint, you know, what we owe the future, or, you know, how to think long term and how to be a good ancestor, can often be just that, a very sort of theoretical, albeit well-meaning conversation, debate, viewpoint, whatever. But your absolute sort of actionability of actually how does one put this into place, I think is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, look, the tagline of the book, Becoming the Great Ancestors Our Future Needs, could be a very philosophical discussion. Yeah. I could argue for intergenerational justice, right?
Normative points of view.
And I do a little bit on the book, and we do a little bit of that in the show. But becoming or being a great ancestor to future descendants, future generations, means that it's in everything that you do. It's in the food that you buy, right? It's in the products that you consume. It's in who and you vote for, and how you engage in democracy, how you interact with those around you. These seemingly small things actually add up. So yes, we cover fusion energy in the show. Of course, we do solar. We know we do a lot of these kind of big macro scale projects. But being a great ancestor doesn't always mean you do that, because not everyone has access to that. They're not, you know, able to invest billions of dollars in massive concentrated solar fields in Morocco, which we go and visit, and it's amazing. Sometimes it actually just means, how do you do something differently in your life, in your work? I say this in the book, and we say this in the show. Being a great ancestor could be pushing this massive multi-decade project around food system. It also means, how do you say goodbye to your kids in the morning when they go off to school? Do you make eye contact? Do you put the phone down? That seems small, but based on a lot of the studies that we've been reading, that very small action can have a great effect, especially over time and especially at scale. So a lot of what we do, again, in the show is kind of move back and forth between these to show that building futures that lead to flourishing for all doesn't require you to be a multi-billionaire or the president of a country. Yes, that can help in a certain way, but it can also help to do it in a way that's very much in your own social direct milieu.
I thought fascinating, again, at that point that you make then, and looking at the information around the series, you know, you're talking about that sort of the saying that you have, you know, to what end? As in, you know, what's my ultimate goal and how do my choices align with my values?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I've met with the heads of, in a previous life, heads of government, heads of policy units, heads of Fortune 100 companies and foundations. And if I'm in the room with them, they're asking kind of two questions: what's going to happen in the future, and how do we position ourselves? And I'll be honest, in the first part of my futuring career, I took that at face value, and I'd say, okay, well, what's going to happen? And we would, we'd look at mega trends and predictions of what could happen, and then we would try to position their organization to kind of ride that wave. And I realized it was kind of like a slow building epiphany at one point when I actually had a meeting in Geneva, but we don't have to go back to that point specifically. Yeah. Who's in the room? But it was clear to me that they were asking the wrong question, because not that, anyone hasn't necessarily a magic wand to dictate the future they want, but I realized they just were all coming at it from a very reactive stance. And the real question is, what do I want it to be? What do I want it to look like? What do I want it to feel like? In many ways, those kind of futures. And so working with folks, be it on the show or in person or on stage, and you kind of similar to me, we live in this life where we're in all these different platforms and channels, because again, we're meeting people where they are. It's unbelievably important to know what it is you want to head towards, like to what end. And you can try this next time, if you're a listener, or Yuzhan, like you're thinking, like you're coming to a major decision point, a kind of a fork in the road, be it for a company, our government, our currency. We just did a currency project. The question becomes, like, to what end? And more often than not, you'll find that the first cut of that answer is actually pretty short term. It's like, well, I want to do this thing in my career because I want to buy this house. Okay, that's fine. Or I want to go on that amazing vacation. I want to be able to pay for it, or whatever. But if you start to kind of step back and say, okay, how do I look at this through a kind of transgenerational lens? all of a sudden your true what ends are changed, because it no longer is just singularly about you, but it actually becomes about something bigger. And that's where, back to your question, it starts to connect to your values, right? Because if we don't ask to what end, we start seeing ourselves, and ourselves could be the companies that we run, the shows that we're on, you know, the governments that we're in, as kind of in a sprint to an end point. Well, I have to what end is to win, to cross the finish line first. But when you really start asking the question to what end, you realize you're actually not in a 100-meter dash. You're actually in a very long intergenerational marathon where it's your job to not just win your singular race, but to carry that baton and pass it off to the next generation. Now, that could be your children. That could be the next person who's going to sit in your CEO chair, which is a hard thing to wrap your mind around. It could be whoever comes next, however you frame that. And that's what this does.
Absolutely superb. But just in terms of the actual series itself, now you've mentioned, in particularly perhaps with regards to episode one, when you seek out individuals and ideas that can shape a better and more sustainable future. But just talk us through the actual series. So I know, so episode two then, so chaos and complexity. What are you talking about there?
So, when I find myself in these conversations with folks, they're like, oh, you're a futurist. So, you know, and the next thing they always ask is, what is going on right now? And how bad is it going to get? And so part of what we have to do is acknowledge the moment that we're in. Everyone has a different name for this kind of moment. I call it an intertidal, which is basically like an interregnum. It's that time between what was and what will be. And for me, we're kind of coming towards the end, especially in the kind of, both in the global north and the global south, but very much in the global north, we're kind of coming an end to the institutions that were built off of Enlightenment ideals, but that didn't have the underlying technological understanding of where we are and where we're going and how that's going to change how we communicate and how we are as a civilization. Those institutions are kind of coming to their use-by date. And that doesn't mean I want to say, let's get rid of governments, let's get rid of the UN, let's get rid of all these organizations, Bretton Woods, IMF. I'm saying those just aren't working for the world that we're in right now. Technology moves at technological speed. Policy and institutions move at a much slower pace, which is actually good in many ways because sometimes we need them, but they're just not working. So episode two is about acknowledging the kind of chaos and complexity of this moment, but again, quickly moving past that acknowledgement towards an understanding that even in the most kind of complexified situations, we actually find ourselves at the frontier of maximum creativity. Because whenever we go into these intertidal zones, which is, again, a marine reference, it's that part of the land that sometimes is above water, sometimes below water, we find the most incredible wildlife because they have to exist in these two zones, above and below. And the ones that have figured out how to do that, how to exist in an interregnum and navigate that successfully, are these amazing creatures. And so we make the argument in episode two that that's the point that we're at. And we can't just keep moving forward as if though this is a normal time. And look, to be honest, a lot of people define this as post-normal. My issue with post is it's non-normative. It actually doesn't tell you what comes next. It's like they talk about we're in a post-Cold War world. We're in a post-normal times. That's great, but you're defining your current moment by what you no longer are. And so the reason we use intertidal and what this episode really gets at is that we're at the end of something, but we're also at the beginning of something else. And I think that's unbelievably important for viewers, for listeners, for readers to understand, because if you don't even have an inkling that there is something beyond this, something normative that you are going to, you fall, and this is basic psychology, you fall into despair and hopelessness.
Yeah, yeah. At which point, episode three, Once Upon a Time, all about stories shaping the boundaries of belief about what is possible. So go on, diving into the fundamental role that storytelling plays in our lives?
I mean, look, in episode three, one of the things we do is we visit these amazing caves in Spain where they show kind of the first first elements of the most primitive storytelling. It's just horizontal marks on the side of a cave. We don't even know what they mean. But what we do know in this one specific cave, south of Cordoba, is that there are both Neanderthal and Homo sapiens at different times inhabiting this cave and drawing and writing on the walls. They're telling stories. They're communicating to others about an externalized world, but that also is coming from the internal, right? And as we move forward, we know that what has moved civilization forward in a transgenerational way has been our storytellers, right? We've gathered around the fire for protection, yes. But then eventually we were around the fire, and it could be the priests, it could be the shamans, it could be the host of TV shows, it could be whoever is writing and telling, it could be podcasters. What we're doing is we're laying down stories and narratives about what the world is, how it works, so that we understand our role in it. It's about purpose. It's about meaning. And so what episode 3 really starts to drive at is underlying the fundamental truths of how we tell stories about the future is that we have a choice. We can tell stories about dystopian futures, and this goes back to the beginning of our conversation, dystopian stories about telling us about what to be afraid of, what to be aware of, which in and of itself is great. Brave New World, 1984.
Yeah.
These stories say, look, if things continue on this certain path, they could get really bad. Yet we're at the point that we need to do that, and at the same time, start telling stories that are protopian, which means not dystopian, not utopian, but about a future where we progress, where tomorrow is better than today, where it's a tomorrow where we would be okay with ourselves or our loved ones being in, right? So it's not Pollyannish, it's not rainbows and unicorns.
Yeah.
So episode 3 is really about the onus that we need to place on our storytellers about how they talk about tomorrow, but also the onus on us as consumers of these stories, right? We talk a lot about, over the years, big tobacco, right? Or big oil. In episode 3, in many ways, we're talking about big dystopia. We're talking about peddlers of dystopia. And this is not a knock on Hollywood studios or TV producers, because the fact of the matter is, A, I consume this stuff because I love it.
Yep.
And B, we all do this in our individual lives. This goes back to the negativity bias. If you think about kind of the rise of anxiety and depression in the world, when you actually talk to psychologists about that and you say, well, what's really going on? They say, well, people are constantly telling themselves stories about what could go wrong or what did go wrong. They're catastrophizing. So if we look at the rise of cognitive behavioral therapy, it's just about telling yourself a different story. So the rise of kind of doomerism or dystopianism.
Yeah.
Yes, it's macro. It's in the entertainment industrial complex, which I'm now a part of. But it's also internal, and it's nobody's fault because we're hardwired that way. And so episode 3 kind of lays out what's happening, and at the same time also lays out what we can do about it.
Absolutely fantastic. And then we'll just go through a couple of the others, I think, that, again, so interesting. So episode 4, you're talking titled Human, about the human ability to increase empathy and compassion. Perhaps one is looking at philosophy, one naturally turns to those like Iris Murdoch with empathy, perhaps Rousseau with the compassion. So perhaps just talk about that and where you go, who you talk with, and how you focus on empathy and compassion in episode 4.
Well, what episode 4 attempts to do, I think, successfully, a couple of things. But one of them is there's a narrative, there's a story out there that humans are selfish, that it's survival of the fittest, that it's Darwinian. And I'm putting Darwinian in air quotes. You can't see it right now, because we have this idea that to get ahead, you have to fight, and you're kind of the lone cowboy. This is very much an American aesthetic, right?
Mm.
That it's you against this is also Joseph Campbell, the hero's journey. This is Star Wars. This is in all of our narratives, that it's the individual. Usually it's the individual man who goes out and conquers and chases back to Moses, right?
Yeah.
And probably even further back. And what the latest kind of scientific literature is telling us when it comes from evolutionary psychology to evolutionary biology and sociology is that it turns out that what helps and has helped for millennia humans move ahead is our ability to cooperate. And that is also coupled with our ability to think about the future. So Marty Seligman, the psychologist here in the States, wrote a book with a couple of others called Homo Prospectus. And he says that what actually helps Homo sapiens move forward is that we're able to do two things: cooperate, and that's through language and storytelling, right?
Yep.
And to think about future scenarios. So if you and how does that play out 60,000 years ago? Well, before then, before this kind of cooperative storytelling, if you and I wanted more protein, we had to go out individually and find something to hunt that was kind of small. But when you and I can now communicate, well, look, there's this really big woolly mammoth. Let's go out and get this together. We can get more meat, more food, and help our tribe and our clan go, you know, further and make it through the winter. But that's not enough, because the reality is when we start to go hunt this woolly mammoth or whatever it is, a lot of different things could happen. It could go to the left. It could go to the right. So we have to actually think about the future. We have to prospect. We have to think in a way about what are the multiple scenarios that could happen and how do we communicate about what we're going to do when that happens. That worked really well in the Serengeti. It worked really well in the steppes of Siberia. Now what we're saying is, as humans, if we want to move forward, we have to reconnect with that ancient kind of technology of cooperation. And at the root of cooperation is empathy, is an understanding of who and what we are. Look, Homo sapiens are one of, if not the only kind of millions of species that are whose eyes contain so much white. Why do they contain white? So we can actually see the gaze of the other person that we're talking to. Why is that important? Because when I look at when I break eye contact, I'm no longer aggressive. When you see where I look, you look in that direction. I look in that direction. These are very base level neuroanatomical ways that we build empathy and connection with one another so that we can really flourish as individuals and as a society. So that's part of episode four, is we kind of lay down that layer. Then we move forward and we start to say, well, then what does it mean to be human in the 21st century? What does it mean to start augmenting what it means to be human? So we meet with Danny Claude up at Cambridge, who has developed a kind of third thumb. And what her work is really doing is saying, well, what does this actually start to do at the brain level? And so, you know, you'll see me in an fMRI machine, right? And they're running these studies. And the goal of that part of the show isn't to say, oh, well, we should all get third thumbs. We should all augment. It's to recognize that we are at this critical juncture in this intertidal moment, in this intertidal era, where we are going to be making critical decisions about what does it mean to be human. So we spend part of that episode talking about what got us here, but then recognizing what got us here won't get us there, right? And so if we're going to start thinking about synthetic biology and changing at the germline level who and what we are, we need to have an understanding of this, the long-term ramifications, the second, third-order knock-on effects, and have that conversation in a way that is nested within the values of what it means to be human. So this, in some ways, I'd say is probably the most philosophical episode of the six, because it's really getting at the crux of who and what we are at this time.
So interesting. And just before we go into the episode six, in terms of that long path, can we just step back a second, Ari, and just talk us through, go on then, your path, how you got to where you are now?
You know, it's funny. You talk to a lot of futurists, people who are doing this professionally, and there's always a path, right? It's always a little bit different. Look, I was typical kid growing up in America in many ways. I was into science and read a lot of sci-fi, but that actually wasn't the main driver of what got me here. The main driver of what got me here, and probably most people would say a very similar thing, was my parents. So it very kind of divergent paths. My father was born in the 1920s in Poland. And in the first few days of the war, he lost two brothers just on the front. And within a few months, he, his mother, his brother, and sister, they were placed in a ghetto. We were Jewish, and the Jewish ghetto went for, you know, an area that was meant to hold 800 people held about 8,000 people.
Yeah, absolutely horrendous.
And it became pretty clear what direction this was going. And his mom and his sister were taken away to a work camp, which actually is Auschwitz, and that's where they perished. And it got to the point where he, his brother, and his father decided to escape. And they did escape the ghetto, but even in that escape, my grandfather, his father, was killed, like, right in front of him. And my father went on to, basically, he joined the Jewish underground. He was a partisan for several years during World War II. Now, what's important about that story isn't just what he did during the war, but it's what he did afterwards, because he decided that the greatest revenge, and I grew up with this story almost every night, the greatest revenge besides just living and making it through World War II, but his greatest revenge against Hitler would be that he has children and he eventually has grandchildren. So that became a kind of underlying ethos around this idea that I talked about earlier about holding the baton and passing it to the next generation.
Yeah.
Now, on the other side of the ledger is my mom. So my mom was an artist, and she trained under Buckminster Fuller, who was kind of a world-renowned engineer, futurist, philosopher, architect. Your listeners will know who he is. And so, you know, a typical dinner at the Wallig family, whatever the issue was, politics, war, art, whatever it was, you had my dad often talking about the past and how important it is for us to understand the past and what got us to this moment. And then you had my mom, who was kind of trained under a futurist, talking about, well, where could it go? And there I was kind of in the middle. And so the futuring aspect, obviously, in many ways, comes from my mom and just how she talked about the world coming up under Bucky. With my father, though, what it did was, and you see this in the book, in a very graphical way, what my dad said is, you know, those who forget the past, and we know where this goes, are kind of doomed to repeat it.
Yeah.
And so what makes this show different, I think, than most shows about the quote-unquote future, and makes my work slightly different, is that, and you've already heard it in the conversation, I tend to go back before I go forward. Not that I'm not optimistic and I want to, you know, work from a clean slate, but so much of who we are as individuals, as societies, and as a species is not dictated in a path-dependent way where we can't break out of it and there's no free will, but it's very much informed by what got us to this point. And so in the work, you know, and that sounds very highfalutin, so let me bring it down. We were working with one of the world's largest automobile manufacturers a couple of years ago in the work that I do. And they recognized eventually that the idea of individual car ownership will eventually go away. It doesn't even make financial sense. It's an old model.
Yeah.
And so the more we talked, then said, okay, well then people will kind of rent or lease and there'll be autonomous vehicles and you'll be part of a network. And I said, we got them there. But where we eventually got this organization, and they're not very public about it just yet, is really to kind of put their shoulder behind an idea that was well known to your listeners in Europe, the idea of a 15-minute city. You should be able to get anywhere you want in your city within 15 minutes by foot or through intermodal transportation. So eventually you will see this company move in that direction, and they're starting to kind of do that. The reason I use them as a kind of model for what I was just talking about is in the conversations with them, we had to bring them back to where we were for centuries as communities, and in many ways, what brought happiness and flourishing, and that people want to be part of a community. They want to actually see their neighbors, but that the modern, at least American, city and urban planning built around the vehicle, where you go from driveway to parking lot back and forth, is leading to unsustainable social psychological outcomes, and they can either be part of the problem are actually part of the solution. So again, framing the work that they are doing and what they are putting out in the world in a both historical and evolutionary context going backwards helps them to think about how they want to do it going forward.
Fantastic. I think it's amazing on that point about 15-minute cities, how again, one, and I think coming back to your earlier point, and have to say, by the way, the idea of having dinner at with your parents just sounds absolutely amazing, the conversations going on there. But that, I think that very could be sort of like Hegelian viewpoint, change is a process, things are circular, etc. There's always a tension there, a dialectic. The tension around the 15-minute city, should we say, debate, stroke, argument, perspective, I think is fascinating. The sort of, as people put it, the World Economic Forum viewpoint, absolutely brilliant, all about community, all about locality. Other side, we're hearing pushback from a different perspective, protests against that, with people holding up banners going, don't lock me into this zone. I don't want to be in your Hunger Games version of the future. I think it's amazing how people are getting it totally wrong in many cases in terms of their understanding of it.
And actually where we brought this one of the world's largest manufacturers in this space is to think about, well, don't fight the 15-minute city, be a part of it and recognize that there are different ways to get around in the 15 minutes. So you could be making bicycles, you can make it different modes. And at the same time, folks are going to want to sustainably move around to the countryside, to other places. So think about yourself not as working as a single, in other words, you're not just making cars, you're providing mobility across different scales and times and spaces. So that's how you kind of move forward and find that synthesis between those arguments.
Yeah. So the whole sort of synthesis issue back to Hegel. So gone then, so episode 6 then, tomorrow's all about examining the ways that we stroke you conceptualize the future and the crucial need to think much, much bigger about what could come next. So go on then.
Yeah, well, so we went from 4 human into 6. So 5 we actually already talked about without saying it's episode 5. Episode 5 is about community and how we are together.
Yes.
And that's what's so important and about the futures that lead to kind of flourishing for Homo sapiens and for our planet is a recognition that if we continue on this solo individualistic hero's journey of what the future is for the individual, we actually just don't get there. It's that simple. So one of the things that we look at in 5, for instance, we look at these communities that have figured out how to both allow for, let's say, single family homes, but for them to be interconnected in a microgrid where they're sharing energy and even food systems and transportation. So again, this goes right back to your 15-minute city idea and an example that it's the community is not a false binary. It's not we all live alone or we all live, 30 to a home, longhouse, right? That there's actually ways forward. This is, again, if it's not clear by now, like I very much was influenced by Hegel in my academic career. And so how do we find that synthesis? So in episode 6, we're really talking about futures. We're really trying to lay down and model how you think about tomorrow's using what you've learned and felt in episodes 1 through 5, right? These, where are we? Where have we been? What's important as individuals? What's important as a collective? And then from that, how do we start to think about futures? Futures that lead to, again, this the F word here, to flourishing for all, right? Because look, we can very much, like, I grew up, and I'm not going to say which shows, because I don't want anyone to do that to me in 20 years. But, over the past 20 years, I watched a bunch of shows about the future and or different futures, but mostly just about a singular official future.
Yeah.
And one thing that was always really apparent was that it was always centered around technology, which is going to be obvious to anyone who's watched those shows or even thinks about the future. But the reality is technology is an amplifier, it's a channel, it's a tool, but it's not the whole, as we say here, it's not the whole enchilada. And what we do in episode 6, without giving any too much of it away, is we show how all these pieces come together to create these flourishing futures, a recognition of where we've been and where we are and where we might go. And what does it mean to be human? And how do we do that in a community? And again, we don't do it in a Pollyannish way where we're just kind of, as if the world as it is didn't exist and we get to just kind of start over. We don't do that at all. And we start episode 6 with a conversation with Kylian Mbappe, who's just not only an amazing football player or soccer player, depending on where you live, but an amazing human being in that he recognized very early on in his own career, but then also as a leader on his team, that to move, I'm going to use the reference that he uses, which is pretty obvious, but to move the ball forward, to take the shot on goal that hits the back of the net, you have to have a vision of that ball actually hitting the back of the net, not a vision of missing it. Mm-hmm. So we touched on this in the beginning and part of our conversation, but he really drives us home. He said, look, when I go out to take a penalty shot, or I'm looking, you know, for any shot on goal, but really a penalty shot because he has a couple seconds to think about it, I'm not envisioning myself missing it. Because if you envision yourself missing it, you are probably 50% of the time you're going to miss it. But if you vision yourself doing it, actually following through all the way so the ball is hitting the back of the net, you are more likely going to do it. And with the obvious metaphor here is, as a society, we don't have that vision. We don't actually know what it looks like for that telos, that ultimate goal, that ultimate vision, to what end. He knows what it is on the field because it's very clear. That's one of the reasons we love sports. It's like the ball either goes into the net, either goes through it goes over the fence. Like it's very, very, or goes to the basket. We know. But as a species on planet Earth that's been around for we've been around for several hundred thousand years, a couple billion years for the planet, but specifically when it comes back to Homo sapiens, we don't actually know what that looks like anymore. Right. And so what episode 6 drives at is we have to first and foremost have those conversations, be it in our home, in our company, in our government, on a planet. What are we aiming for? What does this look like? How do we know what success looks like? And there's no easy answers here. And so in 6, we don't have these visions of these beautiful protopian worlds that everyone should head towards. We have a little bit of that. But really what we're doing is we're asking these kind of deeper questions of our viewers so that they can then go out and ask that both of themselves and ask that in the places where they work and ask that of their elected officials and of their school boards and of their teachers and of their religious leaders. To what end? What is it that we actually are heading towards? And then what is that vision? Because once we start to have that vision, we can start to kind of backcast and figure out what it is that we need to do to get there. And that takes us through the, episode 6.
Absolutely fantastic. As I'm looking here again at some of those notes, whether it's work, marriage, parenting, or simply trying to be a good human on the planet, framing decisions from a much larger scale creates a more fulfilling and sustainable life now and for future generations. It sounds absolutely extraordinary. Well, look, all right, mate, before we begin to finish off, and it's been such an interesting conversation, so thank you so much for sparing the time for this. So I presume now in the run-up to when the series is released and after, you'll be on some sort of epic publicity treadmill.
Yes. I'm going to lots of different places, but look, I'm trying to, at least on my end, lower the footprint as much as possible. So fortunate that technology allows me to talk to folks like you without having to, as much as I'd love to join you in person, it allows me to do this from my home. So it's going to be a lot of podcasts, a lot of going to studios here in New York, which is easy because I can take the train in 20 minutes. And look, the underlying thesis here is if you can't see it, you can't be it. And I got to a point where in conversations with, from my kids to world leaders, we were kind of missing this idea of what does the world look like that we want to see manifest for ourselves and our future descendants. That sounds very new agey. It sounds very woolly. But here's the thing. We've actually been doing that for thousands of years, just kind of off the side of our desk. And we're at a point now where we can actually have a very serious conversation about how do we actually make that happen? How do we actually think about what it is the entire Homo sapien project can lead towards? Not any specific end state. I'm not even saying there's any necessarily one specifically right answer, but we got to have that conversation because if we don't, we're going to just start being even more rudderless. We're going to be wandering in the desert even more than we already are. And hopefully what this show does is it's an intervention, if you will, in a conversation that isn't happening so that it will happen.
Wow. Well, just before we finish off then, Ari, can I just say, just to make sure that everyone is totally clear where they can track you down, to say, in terms of linking with you on social media, getting information from you, etc. So go on then, where are you?
So I am on Instagram at REW. Very, very, very simple. For the show, it's abriefhistoryofthefuture.com. And if you search up abriefhistoryofthefuture.com and then you put your country, in the near term, hopefully, it'll come up and say which listing, which channel, or which kind of streaming provider in your country you can find the show on.
Fantastic. Well, obviously, I'm sure that everyone will be avidly looking forward to that and watching A Brief History of the Future, a journey to seek the individuals and ideas that can help shape a better, more sustainable future for each generation to build upon. So just leaves me to say, Ari Wallach, thank you very much indeed.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to The New Abnormal. This series is brought to you in partnership with the Copenhagen Institute for Futures Studies, which helps clients become futures ready. Just so you know, the issues discussed in these podcasts also link to my speeches. Check out seanpeterc.com for more info. Please listen to previous conversations in the series with many other fascinating guests. But till next time, goodbye.